Good evening, everybody. Thanks a lot for having me here. My name is Jamie Kay. I'm an alcoholic. It's a wonderful opportunity to be here with you. And I haven't spoken in quite some time. In fact, I was trying to think. I was talking to Uncle Jim tonight about it earlier. I don't think the last time I spoke was in Brawley, California, at the roundup there. And a roundup in Brawley is not like a roundup in it's a real roundup, actually. If you guys know Brawley in the El Centro area, so I was out there, I had a chance to talk with everybody there, and it was a real blessing. And I know it's going to be an incredible blessing tonight to speak with you guys. I first off want to acknowledge Donna for her 1 year, 6 months, 1 day. It's that 1 day, man. Be careful the second day, Donna. 240 days for Denise. That's fantastic. It's incredible. And 367 days for Jeff. Awesome job, you guys, taking it 1 day at a time. And that's what it's all about. And I also would like to acknowledge Bill Hatzman. I'm not sure what his title is, but whatever it is, he certainly earned it, I'm sure. I wanted to give a salute to the captains, the chip captain, the Venmo captain, the speaker captain. Thank you very much for your service. We really acknowledge and appreciate what you guys do, and I know your group here certainly does. Also would love to say a shout out to New Hope and New Vision. It's in places like these that I first found sobriety, and I'm getting a little teary because I was in a not as a resident, but I certainly felt like a resident. They supported me like I was a resident at South Bay Pioneers in Chula Vista, California, and that was coming up on about 7 years ago that I got sober there. You know, there's something about recovery groups and recovery homes that it just allows you to really just take the time that's necessary to focus on what's number one. And that number one thing is your sobriety. Your kids ain't going to get you sober. Mom and dad is not going to get you sober. Your pastor, as wonderful as your pastor is, they ain't going to get you sober. It's being among other drunks like ourselves and our relationship with God, which I think is going to really inform your sobriety like nothing else. At least it has in my case, and that's what I'd like to share with you a little bit tonight. In the early years of my sobriety, I got a kick out of sharing all the nasty details of my sobriety, and you probably don't want to hear those. I was hoping maybe tonight that I would talk more about what I did in sobriety, how sobriety has changed me, some of the things that I'm still hanging on to. That because here's the thing about character defects, because that's what I'm talking about right now. You know, character defects, it tells us this in the third and seventh step prayers, that you may have to hang on to your character defects forever. Some of them, not all of them, obviously, but some of your character defects, at least in my case, they're still useful in some way, because I think, and I may be wrong about this, this is just something that occurred to me, but I think it's because it shows people that we're just, you know, we're all alike. That maybe we're sober for a little bit longer, but we're still nursing that huge resentment that just seems to not want to go away, or that ego issue, or the anger issues that somehow we're still kind of working around. I mean, it's progress. It's not perfection. And that's certainly been the case with me, that it's been a long, long time coming, my sobriety, to bring me right here. And I recognize it, and I'm blessed by it. And I'd like to say this too, that I'm blessed by everything that's ever happened in my life. I've come to believe that it's all been for my greatest good. It's all been for my ultimate blessing. And that's hard to say because I had a lot of crappy things happen in my life. And I did a lot of crappy things. And crappy's a nice way of putting it. But those things really did bring me to where I'm at right now. And I'll tell you right now, I couldn't be more excited, or I am so, so grateful for the life that I have right now. And I have nothing. I mean, honestly, I have nothing. If you were to look at material things, I really don't have much at all. I just paid an huge IRS debt with another debt. And I'm grateful that I don't have the IRS breathing down my back, but I still have to pay this thing off, and it's hanging over me just like it always has been. But here's the difference: is I've faced it. I've faced it for the first time. I've faced a lot of the challenges and issues, and I'm still facing them. I'm imperfect, and I'm not always going to be the perfect sober person. But guess what? Today, I think I have a good chance of putting my head down on a sober pillow tonight, that I won't wake up surrounded by a halo of vomit like I used to experience. Funny thing about the vomiting on the furniture. I got a couch in a few years ago when I was still living with my kids, and I just insisted, man, no one can go near this couch, okay? You can't eat on it. In fact, I don't even want to have you sitting on it as little as possible. You know, because I did pay all $250 for the couch. My gosh, don't you know? I mean, I don't want anyone going near that couch. And you know what? My kids listened to me for once. None of them went near the couch. If they came into the living room eating something and they saw me there, man, they turned tail and went right back out and left that couch in a pretty pristine condition for some time. And then, you know, old knucklehead here does what he does and goes out and gets all smoked up and comes home in the wee hours of the morning and couldn't find it easy to get to a bathroom. And the next thing you know, that my beautiful couch, my $200 couch, I vomited all over. And I'll never forget the look on my kid's face coming down the stairs and seeing, you know, dear old dad just covered in puke, and the couch as well. It's fun being a parent, isn't it? It's just absolutely fun being a dad and trying to do those things. And I just remember it was the same thing with my dad. I was born, as Uncle Jim was mentioning, I was born in Orange County at Hogue Hospital. And the reason I ended up there is that both my parents were from New York State. However, in 1956 or 57, I guess it would have been, it was a really bad deal to have a kid without being married. And it's not like it is today. Back then, it was so shameful, and my grandfather was so embarrassed and ashamed of it, that they literally tried to think of the farthest place they could send my mom to, and that was Laguna Beach, California. My grandfather had gone to school with somebody that had a beach house there, and that's where they sent my mom and my grandma, and my mom had me. And immediately, I was placed in an orphanage. So I always attribute my alcoholism that I wasn't weaned sufficiently. I was weaned on a pickle. So I was left there for, I don't know. The story is that I was left there for a period of time, and we're not sure how long I was there for, but it definitely created a resentment in me. At least once I heard about it, I formed a resentment. And but the funny thing is, she wrote my dad a letter, and my dad came running across the country left the Air Force, came running across the country with his mom, my other grandmother, and they came out there. He married my mom. They took me out of the orphanage, and then they both went to Tijuana and honeymooned down there. And I guess that set the stage for me for Tijuana and Mexico, because years later, I ended up living there for a number of years. So maybe I just had a, I don't know, maybe I was predilection for it or something. But the only things that I try to think of some of the things that were important in my early years that I can share right now, and I'm trying to keep mindful of the time because I can see that it's already 7:26. So I'm glad that we have 2.5 hours. I think tonight they said I could do it for 4. And so I'm glad that I've got a sufficient time because, you know, my story is very important. And it's really important that you know every single little tiny detail. So I will make sure that I'll touch on everything for you. So don't worry. I'm going to wrap it up in a short period of time. But anyway, the two things I remember as a kid that kind of related to my alcoholism, I think, three things actually. First is I was about 3 or 4 years old, and I had a knife in my hand. I remember that. I don't really remember how old I was, but I remember having this knife in my hand like a butter knife. And my dad was in the hallway, and I was standing next to a plug, and my dad was in the living room watching television, and I took the knife, and I stuck it in the plug. And the feeling that came over me was one of amazing vibration, and one, like, I mean, I was shocked, literally. And I was, like, literally shaking. And I took the knife out, and my dad got up because he heard the noise or something, and he's looking at me, and I look up at him, and then I take the knife, and I put it back in the plug, because that's who I am. Because if it's not, if one time with the knife is wild and crazy and dangerous, man, two must even be better. And I did it, actually, I think one last time. I think I did it 3 before they pulled me away from it and realized that they had a real knucklehead on their hands. And that was the next thing that happened was that I can remember that has to do with my alcoholism is my dad was always having a beer in front of the TV and watching the game. And he just one day at 5 or 6 years old, he just let me drink it. And it was awful. But I went right back to it. I went and asked for it again. I mean, it was the worst tasting thing I'd ever tasted in my life. And yet I went right back to it because there was something behind that bitterness that called to me. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is today. I've been sober for a little bit, like I've mentioned. And, you know, it's funny. I don't think about alcohol at all, except if I'll be somewhere like in a department store or at work or something, and usually a woman is wearing some type of perfume that all of a sudden reminds me of tequila and vodka. And it's the weirdest thing in the world. I don't know why it is. It's almost intoxicating. And I just, man, I start flashing on that. And I mean, I'm not in danger of getting drunk at that moment, but it just all of a sudden elevates my thinking and the excitement that I have for alcohol. And the last thing in my childhood that I wanted to share was that, you know, I was the oldest, the number one child. I got all the attention and I made sure everybody knew it. And I had a twin brother. I had a brother who was a twin with my sister who was a year younger than me. And I just made his life hell for the first 5, 6, 7, all the way up to 10 years old. I mean, I just really was not a nice guy to this kid. And all of a sudden, he started getting bigger and bigger and wider and fatter and taller than me. And I was getting a little nervous. And one day, we had it out again, and I started bugging him and started bullying him like I normally did, and he let me have it. And he beat the living tar out of me in the garage, and I'll never forget it. And I was so incredibly resentful that I nursed that resentment for the rest of his life. He unfortunately died from this disease, and it wasn't until that I was in the hospital room with him And I was so, I believe I was sober. Yes, I think I was sober when I was in the hospital room where his liver basically blew up like he was 10 months pregnant. I mean, literally, it was just fluid in him that they had to keep taking out of him because he didn't see this deal. I tried to share it with him. But this is a program of attraction. And my sobriety at the time maybe wasn't attractive to him. Maybe nobody had anything that was more attractive to him than him slowly killing himself. I don't know. But all I know is that I did have a chance to scratch his back, massage him, and tell him I loved him. And he just wasn't willing to do what's necessary to stay sober. And it's a sad thing. Because despite the resentment, I love my brother. And anyway, so going forward, nursing resentments, having some kind of connection with alcohol, and I just go through high school, and I remember not feeling good enough for my dad, and I grew up in a small town with, you know, football was like the biggest thing, basketball was next, and baseball was third. And after that, nothing else mattered. And I was horrible at every one of those things. I had no interest in it. Now, give me my guitar and let me sing and let me do that stuff. I was all over it. And dad just, I just didn't get the attention, I thought, from the people around me and my family. And there was a resentment about that as well. And so all of that just made it real, real easy to pick up and start drinking like a fool. And that's exactly what I did. And I drank everything and anything. And I drank to such an excess that I just would, I always drank to be absolutely blacked out drunk. I drank so that I didn't think about anything at all. And that I woke up always in places that I didn't know where I was, what I was about, what happened. I mean, I knew where I was when I was conscious, but as soon as I got knocked out, I didn't know where I was. And that's the way I loved it. That was my solution. That was the way that I dealt with anything that I was felt about the situation in my life and the things that had happened. And around that same time, I experienced sexual abuse that just made me even more a big fan of getting blotto, of being spaced out and stoned and drunk. And of course I did everything else that somebody in the 70s, 60s, 70s did at that time. And I guess they do it right now as well. You know, the weed that we smoked back then, by the way, has nothing on what the weed you guys have now. I mean, it's not even in the same ballpark. And the reason is before I got sober, I got high for the first time in years and years and years. And I'm only because it was part of my being drunk. I had to be drunk first to even want to reach out and smoke some weed. And I couldn't believe it. It just like I was crawling down a highway at 5 miles per hour because I couldn't go any faster. I mean, weed has changed a lot. I really hail anybody that has a drug problem and is coming through it right now. And the reason is that I can't even imagine how difficult it's got to be. And I really do. You've got my blessings as you go through it. But this is about alcohol because that's my gig. That was my deal. And that's what I was about. And I did drink all the way through college. I drank all the way through all of my relationships. I ended up coming from I moved. They said Uncle Jim had said that I grew up in New York City. I didn't. I grew up in outside of the central New York, Utica, New York, up in the country. I was a backwoods kid. See, I always say, you know, there's people that say I'm from New York, and then there's others like me. I'm from New York. That's my bad accent. And so our accent was a totally different thing, as you can tell by listening to me right now, as I still have what we call a Mohawk Valley twang. And I grew up there, and I went through there, and I got to college, and I got to college. It was a really special deal. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of, like, Juilliard, which was a theater school in New York, and mine was the state version of that school. It was a theater school that I got accepted in because I couldn't get accepted on my grades. I mean, that was never going to happen. But somehow, some way, I got into college and I went to school, and man, it was on. What a wonderful time to party. And I just continued to do it. And I continued to do it and do it and do it and do it and do it until there was just nothing left of any type of life. I burned all my relationships. I burned my jobs. I never got fired. I just would leave. I just would leave. And I did everything. I did everything from I sold insurance. I was a bartender. I worked for a dating service in the middle of the night. I would match up people from around the country sitting there. And it was great because I could stay out at the bar all night and go to this place at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and match up somebody from Pennsylvania with another person from Pennsylvania. And it wasn't by computer. It was just like matching their applications up. And I had a couple of marriages to my credit. So some drunk got three or four couples married somewhere. So I did that kind of stuff, and I went upstate, and my alcoholism had progressed to the point where that my mom invited me up back home from New York. I was living in New York City at the time. She invited me back home, and she said, "Listen, we're going to a meeting, and we'd like you to go." And she was with her boyfriend. And her boyfriend, I've talked about this before, is the ugliest man I've ever seen. And my mom has always been a very attractive woman. And this guy, you know, I had a comb over that started here and went all the way over. And he had a weird shaped head. And he had always had a pipe in his mouth. And yet when he opened his mouth and he started talking, God, there was something that was so attractive about the guy. The guy just made it. You just wanted to listen to whatever he said. His name was Tom Gorman. He took me to a meeting. He took me to my first meeting. And I met a gal there who was gorgeous. And I was off and running. I said, I'm signing up for this thing. This is a great deal. I can come here and meet women? Yeah, sure. Where do I go? What steps do you want me to tell you that I took? And I was ready and willing to do it. And so this gal, Cindy, and I, we drove back down to New York where she lived as well. And we hung out for a month or two, and then, you know, we went our separate ways, and I stayed sober. I did stay sober, but the funny thing is I told everybody I was going to stay sober, but I was not going to alter my lifestyle. So I hung out in bars with everybody else, and I sat there and just drank those O'Doul's one after another. And man, you know, if you drink about 15 or 20 O'Doul's, you can get a buzz. It ain't a great buzz, but you will get one. And that's what I would do and tell everybody I was sober and that I wasn't drinking. And I stayed like that for quite some time until I was called out here to California to work and came out here and was still sober. Got some sponsors along the way that they put up with me. I don't know why. They tried to help me, and I just didn't want anything to do with them. And finally, after a while, I just went back out and got drunk again. And this time it was the worst. I mean, I had a wife, fantastic wife. I had my first son, and it was a nice lifestyle. I was making more money than I'd ever made before. I was working as a stockbroker, and I just decided I didn't want to be. My alcoholism got to the point where I didn't want to be around normal people anymore. I wanted to be around as weird of people as I could find. So I moved to Tijuana. I moved to Mexico. And I lived down there. And I hung out in the girl bars all night long and got hammered. And I had some money to live off of. And then I started taking my American Express card and just buying a bunch of junk with it. And then turn around and sell it on the streets in Tijuana. For nothing. I mean, you know, a $200 boombox I'd sell for like 15 or 20 bucks just to try to, you know, have enough money to stay in a hotel down there, which is very cheap, by the way. And that's what I did. And then I got married again from a gal from down there and had another child. And it was really, really bad. There was a lot of violence. I'm not proud of it, but it was just a bad, bad situation. And I finally got moved back up north to San Diego. I was living there with my family, and my second wife basically came to me and said, "Look, I don't want to be with you anymore." And I was heartbroken. I was like, "I thought you were the perfect person, you know?" Because you know why? She didn't speak English. That's why she was perfect. I mean, I could not, I didn't have to express anything. I didn't have to explain anything. I didn't, all I had to do was just get drunk, come home, and just be nice, which I could do. But I didn't have to, there was no, I really think that I chose people at that time that didn't speak English because I didn't have to, I didn't have to converse or communicate. And when you don't communicate in a relationship, it's doomed. And so she was done with me. She just was tired of the kind of lifestyle that we led and how, what we did. And then I was just so crestfallen that it just got worse and worse and worse until finally one night in Chula Vista, California, I was running red lights on purpose because I didn't care. I was drunk again, and I got pulled over by Officer Marquez of the Chula Vista Police Department, took me out of the car, made me walk the line, put me in his car, kindly parked my car so that I could come back and get it, which I thought was, what a nice guy. And then he chained me to a pipe all night in the police department. And that's where I ended up. And I knew right away. I'd been sober before. I knew what to do, where to go. I knew exactly what to do. And I remember that I'd always driven by this place called South Bay Pioneers down in Chula Vista. And I thought, that's where I'm going. And I, next morning, after my ex-wife came and bailed me out, I went to the club house, and I just stayed there. I'd go home to sleep, and I just spent the whole day there. I ignored work, and I just did whatever I could to get sober. And then I had to go to my, the first thing is I had a sponsor who told me, I'm going to be your sponsor. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor. He didn't put it on me to ask him. He said, this is what we're going to do. And I needed somebody to slap me around like that. And that's what I did. And it was an amazing thing. Because this guy, he believed in things differently. I'm going to show you a book. This is not an AA book, okay? It's not approved by AA. This is what I used. You can please talk with your sponsor about it. But this is the one that I use. It's called Back to Basics by Wally P. He went back to the history of AA, and he found that, guess what? Dr. Bob did not take 10 years to take somebody through the steps. He found out that he took them through the steps in about 4 weeks' time. And I know we're like, oh, my God, we can't do that. No, we can't. But that's what they did. And they had the highest rates of sobriety at that time ever since then. So it was an amazing thing. And I was went through that. And not only that, but I went through it. But I was expected to take other people through that at the same time. And all I can tell you is I stayed sober. I started getting involved with the steps. I started thinking about this program and how to work this program. And I started reading the big book. And I started realizing, I heard at a speaker meeting that some lady read chapter, she read 86, 87, every single day, every day of her life. And I started doing that. And great things, amazing things start to happen when you get into the big book and you start to develop that conscious contact with God. And I was amazed. It all of a sudden helped me to look at myself and realize that I had secrets in me that I hadn't shared with anybody. Shame about sexual abuse. Shame about being an abuser of myself, of physical abuse, and being just a total ass with the women in my life. And I could talk about it, and I would discuss it with my sponsor, and it blew my mind. And I still felt I had more inside of me. And then, as luck would have it, I came here to Hanford, California. And I had, I couldn't find a sponsor. So I was still in touch with my sponsor down in San Diego. And little by little, man, the clouds started clearing away. But here's the thing. It was the first time in my life that I ever lived alone. You see, I practiced a couple of things that they told me to do. Number one, they said, don't have a relationship with anybody any type of physical, romantic, anything. Stay sober for a year and then go out and be the whore you always were. No, they didn't say that. They just said stay sober and don't get into a relationship. And for the first time in my life, I listened and I did it. And then I came up here. And I'd gone, after the year, I'd gotten into a bad relationship once again, and I used the job that I got up here to escape, and I came up here, and I lived in an apartment, a little studio apartment, and it was the first time that I really, really started feeling what prayer could be about and how exciting it is. And this is also another non-AA book, E.M. Bounds. Man of Prayer, the irregularity of our modern life is one of the greatest foes to deep spirituality. We are so much away from home. We sleep, we travel at such unreasonable hours that it's often impossible for us to have fixed times and places for devotion. I needed to take time to pray on a regular basis, ideally every morning and every evening, but certainly every morning. That's what it took for me. And all these things started, great things started happening to me. Number one, I met the love of my life, and I'm still such an ass to her on a regular basis, but here was what's incredible that came about it from this program, from sobriety. I could be honest with a woman for the first time in my life. I didn't have any fear about it. I told her everything that ever happened to me, and I could share my life in a way that I'd never shared before to someone of the opposite sex, and it developed an intimacy that I didn't even know was at all possible. We screamed at each other, we yell at each other, and then we apologize, and then we release and let it go, and we begin again. And I still act an ass with her, but she forgives me, and I seek forgiveness, and she also, by the same token, we do the same thing. And I'm sharing only this with you, not because this is like a relationship deal that we're talking about right now, but it's part of my sobriety. My sobriety was about, first, not having shame. Second, about being honest. I don't know about you, but I have such a hard time telling the truth. I can't tell the truth as if my life depended on it. And guess what? My life does depend on me being honest and direct with not only my significant other, but with everybody, with all of you. And it is so hard for me to do. I slip almost daily. But here's what I do now is I do stop and I ask for forgiveness. And I say I was wrong. Yes, I misspoke. I was not being honest with you. And that's an incredible thing. So those are some of the things that I found in this program. The other things were going back and cleaning up the wreckage of my past. I was scared to go back and talk to my ex-wives. They hated me. Well, one hated me. The other one just despised me. And they sat there with arms crossed when I first approached them about making an amends. And it didn't go well. But I kept at it. And little by little, I made the amends that I had to make. And I believe I still need to maybe go a little deeper there. But I felt like an incredible thing that I tried to make something right that I made so wrong, that I'd screwed up so badly. And it was great. And then I had to go to my kids. And you know, I always thought I was a great dad. I knew I loved my kids, but as a drunk, I couldn't be effective as a father. And all I knew was abandonment, lies, the same kind of flim-flam stuff that my dad had hoisted on me, I hoisted on my kids. I did everything that my dad did to me, I did to my kids. And the thing is, I know my dad loved me, but I couldn't stand who he was as a person. And I know my kids loved me, but they couldn't stand who I was and who I had become. And I went to them, and I just little by little worked on it. And you know the most important thing was to leave them the frick alone. Stop bugging them. Stop hanging over them every minute trying to be the helicopter parent that doesn't ever really get it done, I don't think, at least in my case. And so what I did is I just gave them space and time. And little by little, they came around. And you know what happened? 2 years ago, and I'm wrapping up, and just give me a minute. 2 years ago, I, through Ancestry.com, a DNA test brought up a relation, father-child relationship that I had with a young lady. And I knew who it was. It happened when I was 17. It was a one-time situation with a gal that I knew very well, but we weren't boyfriend and girlfriend. And her parents took her off to the Catholic Charities Hospital or whatever, and she had a daughter, and that was it. And this daughter reached out to me. And a couple summers ago, Chris and I went back to Brooklyn, where she lived, near where she lives. She's actually doesn't live in Brooklyn, but we went to her aunt's house, and we met her. And there was not, I mean, it was just amazing. It's amazing, the things that are happening in sobriety. If you'll just allow it, if you'll just get out of the way, thy will be done. Thy will be done. Not my will, not my way of controlling things. Tonight, I sat here and I wanted to just control this whole thing, and it's totally out of my control. I just wanted to just share with you a little bit about where I was, what happened, and where I'm at now. I want to tell you that I love you very much. And I used to say that, I used to hear, you know, speakers say that, and I say, oh God, what bullshit, man. But as I look at all these faces around there, and I see Warren over there, and I see Sean. Hey, this is like Rompa, remember? Bibbidi bobbidi boobity boo. And I see Jim Kay. I see Aurora Ken. I see Denise. And I tell you right now, you're loved. You're loved. I believe I love you, but you know who definitely loves you? God loves you. God has a plan for us, all of us. And all we have to do is get out of the way and not drink one day at a time. That's enough out of me, guys. Thanks very much. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Jay.